Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Valentine's Day can be a landmine if you're not happily coupled up. Our next guest has chronicled the ups and downs of unrequited love and has some ideas for how to bear it.
Samara O'Shea joins us now. She's a writer at the Huffington Post and the author of the new book, Loves Me Not, How to Survive and Thrive in the Face of Unrequited Love. Samara, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
So when you started telling people about this book, did everyone sort of start coming forward with their stories of unrequited love? I imagine it's sort of a universal theme for people.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of knowing nods was the main response.
Well, you start in the book by saying we should acknowledge our feelings, our unrequited love feelings, that we're entitled to them. Is that as easy as it sounds, or is it more complicated than that?
I think you're absolutely entitled to be romantically interested in someone, and I support that, the notion that you're not out of anyone's league. Don't think that way about yourself. And just because two people don't agree to be together romantically doesn't mean anyone's a bad person. There's a lot of things that need to line up. And as far as unrequited love is concerned, I am all in support of taking risks personally and professionally. So I think it's absolutely okay to let someone know you're interested, but instead of giving up after we do that, a lot of times we sort of go into I'm going to win you over mode. You know, the ego wants what it can't have. And that's where it gets to be dangerous, where you're you know, on a mission.
So when the object of a crush doesn't return our feelings, how can we take that without, you know, feeling rejected, that there's something wrong with us?
Oh, that's such a good question. and I've sort of mastered feeling the answer. I'll try to explain, not to take things personally, because everybody, we're all walking through the world looking at each other through the lens of our own insecurities and experiences, some good, some bad. So, you know, you might love the color red and the man you're interested in doesn't. And that is such a little thing that has nothing to do with you. And we take that personally and suffer because he's not interested in me. I understand it goes beyond the color red. I'm just trying to give an easy example.
But it's this huge, fraught situation. You're interested in someone. Maybe it's love or a crush or something like that. You put it out there. They're not interested back. How do you make that not be a statement on yourself? I mean, it's more than just not liking similar things.
Yeah, that's true. What we're doing when we're interested in someone and kind of holding out hope that they will like us is we hand over our self-esteem to that person. Like, as soon as he recognizes me, as soon as he gives me the time of day, if he breaks up with his girlfriend for me, then I will be validated. So it's a matter of learning to validate yourself and say, you know what, I'm going to give this a chance, see if someone's interested. He's not interested. That's absolutely disappointing, but it doesn't have to be devastating if you don't give over your self-esteem.
Well, you tell a story in your book that sort of illustrates that, and it's the love life of Edith Wharton, who wrote The Age of Innocence, and her love life was pretty topsy-turvy. You want to tell us about sort of the man she found passion with later in life?
Yes, so Edith Wharton married at a young age, and they were both from very wealthy families, and it got off to a very rocky start, and they were sort of miserable in their marriage for years, and she fell in love maybe about when she was in her mid-40s. And she fell in love with a journalist, and they had a very passionate relationship. But it was she was very interested, and she very much wanted to be with him. And he was the player. And he was with Edith sometimes, and he was with other women. And she eventually cut it off and went on to write a Pulitzer Prize-winning book. So I think that's how she got over it.
That helps.
Success can be the best revenge.
Yes, or the best process. Just the writing process is certainly therapeutic.
Well, on the other side of what I'd presented earlier, taking the person's rejection as a judgment on us, how can we resist the idea that if they don't like us back, there's something inherently wrong with them?
I think that bleeds into the narcissism of you don't want to go around assuming anybody who's not interested in you is worthless. That's the other side of the coin that is equally unhealthy. You just kind of shrug your shoulders. And I know it's not easy, but if you do it a few times, if you practice, just kind of shrug your shoulders and say, nobody's a bad person, not me, not him. And there are things that make you a bad person if he does go out with you and lie to you, and if you get to a certain stage and it's an unhealthy situation. But if it's just an initial interest and you're telling someone you're interested and he's not interested, I think that can kind of be shrugged off.
One thing that it seems like would help if we could sort of process it at the time is that obsession is not the same thing as love. And to try to sort of sift through that and recognize it when we're just kind of freaking out and obsessing, and when there's actually genuine feeling there. Do you have some advice for how to separate the two?
It's difficult at first because infatuation is the initial stage of love and of obsession. And I think something can start out very fun and you have those good feelings, those butterflies, and that's not to be tossed aside. It's a great experience. But yes, if somebody decides they don't want to go any further with you and you are obsessively checking in on them, whether it's obsessive texting or cyber stalking, if you are doing all the work and you're not really getting any response, then it's gone into the obsessive direction.
I love your title on this one, Silence Your Inner Psycho. But I imagine people in this situation don't think, I am now going to become intensely creepy. They just, it sort of creeps up on them. What are the warning signs? You mentioned the, I'm sending all the texts and not getting them back. Mm-hmm. What are some other warning signs that, hey, maybe it's time, take a time out, step away for a while?
I think you need to try to tell yourself, okay, I'm not going to his Twitter feed. I'm not going to his Facebook page. And I'm sorry I'm saying him. It's the pronoun I'm using that certainly applies to hims and hers. So I just want to make that clear. Try to stop yourself. It's sort of like people who say, I can quit smoking whenever I want. Okay, then quit. Stop. And if you have a very difficult time stopping, then you need to take a step back and really try to control your behavior.
Social media can be complicated because it's so tempting. You can get these peaks inside people's personal lives that can feed your crush or your obsession, but it can sort of be kind of toxic at the same time, can't it?
Absolutely. It feels like you have a sense of control. Oh, I know what he did last night. Oh, I see what these photos look like. And it's an absolutely false sense of control. You have no input or say in someone else's life. And it feels like you're not doing any harm because it's not literal stalking. You're not outside someone's house with binoculars. It's just innocent little computer stalking. Nobody knows you're doing it necessarily, but you're harming yourself. You're making an obsession last longer than it needs to in some cases.
We're getting into the stalking territory, but is there anything inherently wrong with just having crushes? They can be a fun and positive thing, can't they? Even if they never turn into anything.
Yes, I am calling unrequited love when it's distracting you from your daily routine, when you are feeling down, you're feeling bad about yourself because someone's not interested. Again, your self-esteem has been handed over. But a crush, if you've got a crush on a coworker, the guy at Starbucks, that's great. Yeah, absolutely. Smiles and flirting, that's fun.
We're talking with Samara O'Shea. She's a writer at the Huffington Post and the author of the new book, Loves Me Not. We're talking about how to survive unrequited love today in the lead up to Valentine's Day.
And we want to hear from you. How did you survive unrequited love? Do you have advice or stories to share? Well, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking now with Samara O'Shea. She's a writer at the Huffington Post. She's got a new book out, and it's called Loves Me Not. We're talking about how to survive unrequited love today in the lead up to, of course, Valentine's Day.
And we want to hear from you. How have you gotten through unrequited love in your life? Do you remember maybe your first crush probably didn't go anywhere? Maybe give us a call and tell us that story. Do you have advice for people in the situation of experiencing unrequited love? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Samara, We've been there. We've been rejected. Now, how do we overcome that feeling of rejection for the next time to put ourselves out there again someday? Samira, are you there? I think we've lost the connection with our guest, Samira O'Shea. You can call in, though, with your stories of rejection and unrequited love at 800-642-1234. While we hopefully try to reestablish contact with Samira O'Shea, author of the book Loves Me Not. We'll periodically check in to see if she's on the line. Samira, are you there?
Here, can you hear me?
There she is.
Yay.
So okay, sorry about that.
Not a problem. So my question was, how can you psych yourself up to overcome that feeling of rejection, get out there again after you've been rejected once, and you know, not be gun-shy the next time?
I think it's so important to kind of become a master of rejection, because there's always rejection in life, and including, let's say you meet that person, you end up getting married, including in romantic relationships. You're not always going to agree. You're going to reject each other's ideas sometimes. And I think if you can just sort of master rejection in that you accept that it's going to happen sometimes, and you know a life of risk is a worthy one, and just continue to do it, continue to be rejected personally and professionally, and then you kind of get used to it. Some things will work out, some things won't, and you've got a nice little volley going on.
That's a tough sell. I'd like to have mastery over a lot of things. I don't know if rejection is at the top of my list, but I can see that it could have positive effects too. Well, let's get
our
callers.
There's a section in the book called Singing in the Rain of Rejection.
Singing in the Rain of Rejection. That's good. I like it. All right, well, let's go talk to our caller here. Ben is joining us from Lake Geneva. Hey, Ben.
Hey.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. I was just, my thought when I heard this show was, I have met tons of perfect, perfect girls in my life. However, it was well into my 30s when I realized that they weren't perfect for me.
Mm-hmm.
There was no, it didn't matter, you know, what I did, because it wasn't me. But they were still wonderful women. They just needed to find the right mate, and I wasn't it.
Interesting. Thanks a lot, Ben. And that makes me think maybe we should lower the stakes of our crush and our unrequited love. It might seem at the time like this is the one, right? This is the life partner, the soulmate, whatever. But as Ben found, maybe he met lots of not soulmates and he could wait a while.
I've done the same, where I've met someone and thought, oh, he's absolutely perfect. And what has helped me get over that is nobody's perfect. And it's not fair to go into a relationship expecting perfection of somebody. They are inevitably going to let you down. So I think it's just managing of expectations that can be very helpful.
What about the role of friendship when we're talking about unrequited love? Because the temptation is, like you said, you go into narcissist mode, and mm-hmm. it seems like people can talk your ear off about their unhappy love affairs or the love that isn't returned. What's the balance there with friendship?
I think one, we were talking earlier about how to tell if you're in an obsessive situation. And if you're blowing off your friends, that is a good sign. You can use your friends as a gauge. A new relationship is certainly exciting, but not enough to discard your family and friends. So that is one way to tell. And then, of course, if you are in depressed mode of after a breakup or something didn't work out, it is very tempting to talk about yourself and really talk your friend's ear off about the situation. And I say you have a certain amount of time to do that, depending on how long you were with the person. Maybe a week, maybe two, longer, you know, if it was a very long relationship. But you have to be careful with your friends. They're not therapists. They have problems of their own. You can't take up all of their time with your problems.
Talking with Samira O'Shea about her new book, Loves Me Not, talking about unrequited love and how to get through it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call in with your stories about unrequited love, advice, or maybe a question. And Samira, speaking of friends, you don't just write about romance in your book. You talk about platonic love being unrequited, potential friends who maybe don't want to be friends back. How do we deal with that situation?
It takes a little bit longer to notice. If someone you're romantically interested in isn't calling you back, you notice right away. Your ego is all in it. But sometimes time will go by, weeks, months, and you'll notice the friend isn't giving you the time that you want either. And women especially take this very personally. I don't mean to play the gender card, but I know some of my friends will be very upset if they don't hear back from girlfriends in what they consider to be a reasonable amount of time. So it's a matter, I think with a friend, it's easier to sit down and say, hey, are we okay? You know, I sense you're pulling away. Or it's also important to accept that not all friendships last forever. I think we expect friendships to last longer than romantic relationships sometimes, and they don't always. Sometimes people outgrow each other. And again, it doesn't mean anything's wrong with anyone. It just, we've gone in different directions.
Going back to the romantic side of things again, I mean, do you think there's something sweet about remembering those first crushes? Not everything has to be a big emotional. The only word that's coming to my mind is furball, which is not the right word,
but it's an emotional bad word thing.
You know, maybe it can be sort of a sweetness that we remember.
No, I agree. And once over my early unrequited loves and then unrequited loves in my 20s, once I'm over them, I do remember the sweetness and that just have the nice nostalgic feeling. And I certainly remember the lessons that I've learned, but the bitterness melts away, and that's very nice.
How about a situation of unrequited love with someone we're going to be around, somebody in our circle of friends, coworkers, classmates, whatever? How do you socially navigate that situation? You've put yourself out there, been rejected nicely or otherwise. How do you get along?
I think you have to consider that before you make the move. And a lot of times people say stay in silent unrequited love so that they have a you know, strong feelings for a coworker, but, oh, he's married, so I'm never going to tell him. And you can kind of get stuck in that situation. So sometimes it's a matter of sitting down with yourself and asking, am I going to say something? And if the answer is no, he seems happily married, then you kind of have to act as if you were rejected, act as if he did reject you so that you can move on, because you can kind of stay and stare and hope things work out for a little too long. Don't work out for him. Sorry.
Do you think for our own sort of mental health, it's always better to clear the air and say something so it's just sort of out there? Or is it sometimes better to just, you know, let it be, put it on the shelf and deal with it yourself?
For myself, I believe in taking the risk. And putting yourself out there, I think that's I prefer to do that than wonder years later. Well, what would have happened? You know, I don't wonder how anything would have gone. I know, and people are certainly welcome to choose otherwise. They, especially if it's the case of unrequited love with somebody who is in a relationship, you don't want to take that risk.
But that's how you become a master of rejection. You tell people every time.
Exactly, it's true.
Well, some people are massive chickens when it comes to this kind of thing. I'll name names. Me, back when I was still out there. How would you suggest someone get over that chickenhood and put themselves out there and let somebody know they're interested?
I think you have to accept that rejection is an option. Would you agree that that's the fear? The fear of rejection is what keeps you silent or keeps you from saying anything?
Oh, it's been so long. I don't remember. But I've been married for 15 years tomorrow, actually.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
You got
thank
married
you.
On Valentine's Day?
So this is, yeah, well, I don't want to go there. This is ancient history we're talking about. I don't know.
Okay.
It's just general cowardice, I think.
Okay. So for anyone going through it, presently, maybe try and figure out what the source is. Is it the fear of rejection? Is it low self-esteem, the assumption that, oh, he or she would never be interested in me? And try to find the source of it and maybe work on it from that point before mustering up the courage.
And what about advice that, the best advice? You've written this whole book and you've shared lots of personal anecdotes within the book from your own life, from your friend's life. What are two or three key points that people can carry with them when they're in these situations? Maybe on Valentine's Day, gritting their teeth tomorrow.
Oh, that's a great question. So tomorrow for Valentine's Day, what has helped me get through Valentine's Days as a single is to realize that couples aren't always having a great Valentine's Day. And not for Schadenfreude's sake, but just I have friends who are very happily married who roll their eyes at Valentine's Day. They feel it's more obligatory at this point. So I think the only people who are really having a fabulous time on Valentine's Day are those who are newly dating, because everything's fresh and new and how fun. But they're couples aren't kicking their heels up over Valentine's Day either, so that may help the singles get through it. And I've had some fantastic Valentine's Days as a single with girlfriends. I've done some fun things. I've done the radio on Valentine's Day.
So I think the take-home here, unrequited love, not the end of the world. It's something we can look back on with fond memories if we do it right. Is that right?
Yes. Not only not the end of the world, but possibly a necessary step in a great piece of literature like it was for Edith Wharton, or a fun book as it was for me, or songs. Or, I mean, unrequited love is such inspiration, ends up being inspiration for a lot of artists. So it might be the thing that turns you into another passion.
Well, Samira, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insight today.
Thank you both. Happy anniversary, Rob.
Thank you. Thanks.
Samira O'Shea is a writer at The Huffington Post. She's the author of the new book, Loves Me Not, How to Survive and Thrive in the Face of Unrequited Love. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our Curious Wisconsin segment takes us back to Civil War-era Wisconsin, to a colony of freed slaves.
First, newly elected Menominee Chairwoman Lori Bovine delivered the State of the Tribes address today at the state capitol. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel called it one of the biggest speeches in recent history for her people.
Her tribe, the Menominee, are awaiting a decision on their Kenosha Casino proposal, a proposal that's contested by other tribes in Wisconsin. Issues that unite the tribes include preventing mines in northern Wisconsin and a movement to rename Native American-themed school mascots.
Last year, the Lakota Rite chairman harshly criticized the state legislature, and the Assembly Speaker Pro Tem at the time, Bill Kramer, walked out. Former Menominee Chairman Craig Korn announced earlier this month that the speech today would strike a more conciliatory tone. WPR State Government Reporter Sean Johnson joins us now to talk about the State of the Tribes address. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sean, so the big issue that I imagine was hanging over the speech today for the Menominee Nation was their Kenosha Casino proposal. Did it come up?
It did not. I mean, it was sort of alluded to, but not in the way that you might have expected with the Menominee giving the address. Actually, just looking back, back in mid-January, I had a chance to talk to then-Chairman Korn, and, you know, it had just been decided that the Menominee were going to give this address. And at that time, Chairman Korn was saying, yeah, we're going to talk about the casino proposal. That's huge for us. But, you know, over the course of the editing process, you know, that got dropped. This is a speech that represents all the state's tribes. And, you know, Craig Korn, who was hoping to be the chairman to give this speech today, wasn't there. It was Chairwoman Lori Bovine.
And she was elected, I understand it, on Sunday.
Right, and it's a regularly scheduled election, so it's not like, you know, there was any kind of surprise uprising or change. But you did have this change of leadership very close to the speech. Still, though, she definitely had a lengthy speech, hit on many issues near and dear to her heart, to the tribe's heart.
Now, she was delivering this speech feet away from leaders of the Potawatomi and the Ho-Chunk tribes who contest the casino. Was there tension there?
You know, if there was, you didn't see it, and it could be because it was, you know, it was a fairly politically deaf speech. She didn't get into an issue that divides them. And really at a time when her tribe is asking the governor for approval of this tribe, you know, she didn't have a speech that was filled with attacks on him or any of his policies, really. The notable exception would be on the mascot bill, which she did touch on. But, you know, for something like the mining bill, which was a huge issue in last year's State of the Tribes address, where, you know, tribes have been very critical of the legislature and the governor, steered clear of mentioning that mine specifically.
So in terms of issues that unite the tribes, tell us about some of the areas she touched on.
Well, on the mascot bill, that is one where you don't see, you know, any splintering among tribal leaders. They all believe that the change that the legislature made this year that would make it, you know, would make it hard to remove a school mascot that's a Native American mascot was a bad idea. And so, you know, that she felt definitely at liberty to speak on that on behalf of all the tribes. And she said, you know, that their children, that Native American children should not be subjected to inaccurate representations of their culture. And you had, at that moment, half the assembly stood and applauded, Democrats who voted against the change this year, and Republicans largely stayed in their seats.
And there was supposed to be a more conciliatory tone. At least that was what had been sort of previewed when we thought that Chairman Craig Korn would be doing the speech. Was there a conciliatory tone?
Yeah, I mean, I think there still was. I mean, as far as a news lead, it's going to be that the comments about the mascot bill. But if you look at the rest of the speech, by and large, she thanked the legislature repeatedly for, you know, smaller bills that the tribes did support. She multiple times talked about being a partner with the legislature on issues that affect them both, and, you know, talked about trying to forge compromises and find common ground where they can. So, you know, from a news perspective, there's going to be a lot of focus on what she said about the mascots. But if you were sitting there listening to the speech, you know, this was definitely a speech that struck that conciliatory tone.
And Sean, I'm going to jump in. We're experiencing some technical difficulties hearing you. Can we move to the phone quickly and easily?
All right, I'm right. You can get me.
All right, and there you are.
All right, excellent.
Okay, I think that's going to be better for everyone.
Okay.
So you were talking about the tone there, and I wonder if, given the tension surrounding the proposed Menominee Casino, was this speech at all a departure from speeches of years past?
You know, in the last couple speeches in recent memory, there has been a lot of tension. Because you had this issue, the potential iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin was just this outstanding issue that was either being dealt with or was about to be dealt with. And, you know, for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, one of the state's 11 federally recognized Native American tribes, you know, that was a huge issue and one that they continue to fight as hard as they can. And, yeah, so you had a very contentious nature there, and that just doesn't exist. That didn't exist in this speech. It's not that some of the same issues aren't out there. You didn't see them come up in the same way. And you know, as I mentioned, she didn't even mention the mining bill specifically. And as far as the Kenosha Casino, you know, maybe not every legislator's on the same page there, but you do have Republican leadership in the assembly very strongly behind her tribe's, you know, proposal to get that casino. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is in favor. A number of lawmakers are in favor. And, you know, even if they weren't, that's not in their court right now. It's in the governor's hands to make that decision.
Now, as I understand it, the person who gives this address rotates each year, yes. And that this year it happened to be the Menominee tribe's turn. But do you have a sense of how much cooperation there is and communication among the tribes, especially in the lead up to an address like this?
I think they were down to just a couple tribes who hadn't given it. And so in talking to the Great Lakes Intertribal Council a few weeks back, seeing that the Menominee was going to give this speech, you know, immediately you think, well, they're doing that because of the casino. But in talking to the Great Lakes Intertribal Council, at least what they told me, they didn't view it that way. It was just a matter of who's left and giving these speeches. It is something that the legislature's been doing, you know, back since 2005 now, every year in the state assembly. And so this was the Menominee's turn, and it came at a good time for them. You know, it's not something that they use to kind of hammer home the point of the casino bid.
So before we let you go, any sense of issues that may be taking more of a priority as we go forward into the year?
You know, in terms of what she talked about there, the ones that really grab your attention, the mascot bill, it's not going to change in the legislature. I mean, they feel like they've addressed that. The governor signed it. In terms of mining, that's something, and environmental issues, you know, that's just going to be, that's just a really broad issue. And it was in the way that she laid it out. And that's going to be an issue where you have continued tension between the tribes and the legislature.
Sean, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate
All right, thanks,
it. Veronica. We've been talking to Sean Johnson, WPR's state government reporter. He's talking about the State of the Tribes address delivered earlier today.
In today's edition of Curious Wisconsin, we visit a lost piece of Wisconsin history.
During the Civil War, a group of freed slaves found their way to Wisconsin and became part of a community in Dodge County.
Gregory Bond joins us now. He's a historian researching freed slaves in Civil War era Wisconsin. We've linked his recent New York Times piece on the Central Time Facebook page. Gregory, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is the Fox Lake Negro Colony, it was called at the time. How did it get started?
It's an interesting question. It's a long history. It actually starts, if you go back to the beginning of the Civil War, a very important decision was made by Union Army and political leaders to classify slaves who escaped to the Union Army lines as contraband of war, mm-hmm. and they would not therefore be returned to their owners who they escaped from. So this naturally encouraged lots of slaves in the South to try to escape when they had the chance. And the colony got started when several freed slaves from Alabama, Arkansas, and Kentucky made it to various Union Army camps and then were sort of taken care of by the Union Army, and they eventually ended up in Cairo, Illinois, at the very southern tip of Illinois, in a contraband camp.
And in the piece I just mentioned, the New York Times, you tell the story of Samuel Matthews and his family. Can you tell us how they came from slavery to Wisconsin?
Sure. They were in northwestern Alabama in Franklin County near Tuscumbia, and the army of Union General William Rosecrans was nearby. And the local population in Alabama talked of impressing Samuel Matthews into service in the Confederate Army as a cook, and he didn't want to fight for his master's army. So he and his wife, Sarah, and his two children, Richard Matthews and Ellen Matthews, they escaped and ran away from their plantation and made it to Tuscumbia, which was being occupied by Union Army troops. And then they sort of followed the Union Army into Mississippi and eventually to Helena, Arkansas, where there's a contraband camp, and then eventually to Cairo, Illinois, which was the main contraband camp in that part of the country.
And then that next step from Cairo, Illinois, up to Dodge County.
Yes. At the same time, this is all happening in the South. In Dodge County, of farmers in Trenton, Wisconsin, which is in sort of northeastern Dodge County between Fond du Lac and Fox Lake, the farmers were running into manpower shortage. They didn't have enough people to help them till the land.
Because so, presumably some people were away
exactly,
at the front.
Exactly. A lot of soldiers from Dodge County were in the Army. So it was a very Republican area, staunchly Republican, supportive of the war. And they get this idea of they knew that there are all these freed slaves in the South who had escaped from their homes and were in these camps with nearly nowhere to go. So they organized a group of farmers who were willing to host these freedmen. And they sent Edison P. Cady, who was an elder in the Baptist Church in Trenton, went down to Cairo and found about 39 African-Americans freed slaves who were willing to come to Dodge County and work in these farms.
Including Samuel Matthews,
including
who we were
the Matthews
talking
family.
About. How did Wisconsin's white residents react to the arrival of this community of freed slaves?
That's a good question. They were split, as you can imagine. The Civil War, especially, this happened in 1863. The freed slaves arrived in Trenton in March or April 1863. The war was 3 years old at that point. Sort of a stalemate in certain places, and the white population was split. Some people in Dodge County were very supportive of the war, the farmers who brought the freed slaves up, but other people in Dodge County, especially it seems like in Beaver Dam, were what they called copperheads, Democrats who opposed the war. And it was very controversial when the freed slaves were brought up. And the Beaver Dam Argus, one of the leading newspapers in Beaver Dam, was very critical of these freed slaves coming to Dodge County.
And do we know, are there records of what those freed slaves made of Wisconsin? It's a very different environment in terms of people, climate, everything, really.
Unfortunately, it's hard to get at records of the freed slaves talking for themselves. Most of the available resources are in white newspapers or people talking about white people in Fox Lake talking about the community in retrospect. They seemed to be happy. They were integrated into the local white church in Dodge County, the Baptist Church in Trenton. They were taken by their patrons to go to church. Many of them stayed in the area, which I find indicative of the reception they got and how they liked it. Through most of the 19th century, a lot of these immigrants actually stayed in Trenton and then moved to Fox Lake eventually. So they seem to have liked the change.
Doing a research like this, I imagine there must be like a holy grail out there to like find a diary or if they didn't write an oral history transcription or something like that?
That would be the Holy Grail. One of the reasons that makes this project actually doable is there is a woman in Fox Lake who worked at the Fox Lake Public Library. She was the daughter of a local politician in Fox Lake in the early 20th century, Harriet O'Donnell. And she, in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, when most of the African Americans moved on, interviewed people in the area, including the few, it seems, the few remaining African Americans, and wrote a bunch of stuff that was unpublished that was just sitting in the Fox Lake Public Library, her sort of summary of these interviews she did with both white people and black people who remembered the colony. So that really makes, and she was a good historian. Pretty much everything I can check out in the other sources, she was right on. So some of the stuff that she writes about that I can't verify through other sources seems to be reasonably accurate. But beyond that, I'm in the process of trying to track down some of the relatives of the people of the African Americans who came to Fox Lake. And I'd love to perhaps find some pictures, some letters, some stuff you're saying from the people who came to Fox Lake. I haven't contacted anyone yet, but I'm hoping something was saved through the years for these families.
About how many freed slaves ended up living in that community?
Sure. The original group is about 39. It varies between 35 and 40, the newspaper is talking about. And it was successful. They, like I said, most of them moved to Fox Lake. By as early as 1865, the Samuel Matthews and his family bought a house in October 1865, and other families moved to Fox Lake. And it grew. Other people, other African-Americans moved to Fox Lake. I think these were people who were who had known the immigrants when they're in the South. And so more African-Americans came to Fox Lake. And by about 1880, the census records 66 people in Fox Lake, which is about 7% of the population, with about 10 other people in surrounding areas. So it seems to peak around 76 or 80 residents. And then, unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, the community gets smaller as we go through the rest of the 19th century.
Yeah, let's talk about the Civil War ends, slavery ends in the South. What happened to the Fox Lake community then?
It thrives for a while. In the 1870s, they start a church, a congregation of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, which seemed to be the center of the community. The church had, they had Christmas tree celebrations, they had Thanksgiving dinners, 4th of July celebrations, they had ice cream socials, strawberry ice cream seemed very popular. And these festivals seemed to be attended by the African American community, but also by white people living in Fox Lake. And there are stories of white and black men of working age going to Chicago, going to lumber camps in Wisconsin, working together. So it seemed rather successful for a while. But by about the 1890s, two tensions sort of are operating on the community that tend to cause the community to disperse. First is the mechanization of farm labor. Most of these men worked on farms, and you have farm labor being mechanized, so you need fewer and fewer people to actually be out in the fields. And that means a lot of people lose their livelihoods. So they tend to go to bigger places, Beloit, Milwaukee, especially Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh, for better economic opportunities. But at the same time, we usually consider, when we think about race relations in the United States, a straight line from slavery or segregation to integration. Things just sort of happen in a straight line. But it's not that simple. These things ebb and flow. Race relations are better sometimes, worse sometimes. And it seems throughout the country in the 1880s, 1890s, after Reconstruction, when the North sort of steps away from protecting the political rights and social rights of African Americans in the South, throughout the country, it becomes more problematic interactions between the races, and this affects Fox Lake. And you have a series of incidents where especially black men are dating white women, and that causes some trouble in the community. But I think it's bigger than just – I think that's often one of the excuses used to sort of justify not liking relationships between blacks and whites. So it seems in a greater sense – things weren't going well between the white residents and black residents of Fox Lake, which also encourages people to leave for greener pastures.
So a community that welcomed these freed slaves during the Civil War, a generation later, is in some ways turning against
them.
Yeah,
it seems to be the case, unfortunately.
Was this, in your research, the only community like this in Wisconsin, or were there others in the state?
There were a few others. Actually, in Fond du Lac in 1862, another group of freed slaves from this contraband camp in Cairo came up to Fond du Lac in 1862. And there are also a few other rural areas, one in southwestern Wisconsin, which has gotten the most attention historically. But it's very few. It's rather unusual to have these communities of African-Americans in Wisconsin at this time period.
And just briefly, one thing I forgot to ask, these people like Samuel Matthews ended up in Wisconsin. Did some of them go back and fight in the war before it ended?
Yes, actually, Hayden Netter comes to Fox Lake in 1863, and then 9 months later, he's drafted by the Union Army and fights in three different white regiments, mostly white regiments, which is rather unusual. Yet a handful of African American soldiers who actually fight alongside white men instead of in the colored units, and there are a couple other people from the area who go and fight in the Union Army.
And Samuel Matthews lived in Wisconsin for a while after
the war.
He
did. He dies in 1896. His wife, Sarah Matthews, dies in 1914. And his family, actually, the only family that stays in Fox Lake through the 20th century. And the Matthews' great-great-granddaughter just died a couple years ago before I got a chance to interview her. And she seemed to be the last direct descendant of the original immigrants in Fox Lake. There are a few other ancestors in Beaver Dam and other parts of Wisconsin across the country. I'm trying to track some of these descendants down.
Gregory, thanks for joining us and good luck.
Oh, thank you very much.
That's Gregory Bond. He's a historian talking about his research on the history of freed slaves here in Wisconsin.